Hello, Gallatin Valley and online listeners. You are listening to KGVM Bozeman Community Radio, broadcasting at 95.9 FM and streaming at kgvm.org. I'm Roxana, and this is Desert Oracle Radio Replay. Did I see you at the parade? Since I imagine you're catching your breath after either taking in Slam, Sweet Pea Festival, or avoiding them altogether, today we are doing another double feature. The bird you might be hearing in the background is a Pacific wren I recorded on a campground in Olympic National Forest last week. We might have some surf sounds too. I'd love to tell you about that trip, but there are two new episodes of Desert Oracle Radio, and I want to be sure we are as up to date as we can be on this show. So today, first up, is Where They Built the Bomb, produced on July 21st. Next up will be The Waning Moon, UFOs, and Their Pentagon Propagandists, produced just a couple days ago on August 4th by Ken Lane. Buckle up!
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California, now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert. It's one of those summers like we always have now. It's just too hot. Let's do a Manhattan Project to fix the damned climate. How about that? Just quietly get it done behind the scenes. Governments cannot do anything really today but enrich the defense contractors, so we will have to do it ourselves. You know what to do. More or less, we'll have a secret meeting. Keep your ears open. Meanwhile, encourage people to keep arguing about it. Pay them a few grand a month. Cover every angle. Keep them out of trouble, off the streets, out of sight. Keep them on Twitter. Some on Twitter, some on whatever Facebook garbage product, some on AM radio weekday call-in shows. They still have those. And let's have somebody standing on the corner with a cardboard sign with a weird message with all the words spelled wrong. Let's just continue with the planned obsolescence and controlled demolition of the Tower of Babel. Does anybody know the story of the Tower of Babel anymore? Did anybody here go to Sunday school? Well, it's a real short story. It's about the length of an Instagram caption, meaning four paragraphs of tiny text. Let's read it together so we can better understand the references that older people occasionally make in their newspaper op-ed columns. The Tower of Babel, Genesis chapter 11. Now the whole world had one language and a common speech. As people moved eastward, they found a plain in Shinar and settled there. They said to each other, "Come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly." They used brick instead of stone and tar for mortar. Then they said, "Come, let us build ourselves a city with a tower that reaches to the heavens, so that we may make a name for ourselves. Otherwise, we will be scattered over the face of the whole earth." But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower the people were building. The Lord said, "If one people speaking the same language have begun to do this, then nothing they plan will be impossible for them. Come, let us go down and confuse their language so they will not understand each other." So the Lord scattered them all over the earth, and they stopped building the city. That's why it was called Babel, because it was there that the Lord confused the language of the whole world. From there, the Lord scattered them over the face of the whole earth. A very short story. That's literally all there is to it. And it makes no sense, really. First of all, who is the Lord talking to? Let's go down, etc. Who is the Lord complaining to? Well, when the Tower of Babel story was first making the rounds, there were many gods. Each area had a god. Some gods were truly everywhere, like Pallas of Troy, who was also Athena and Minerva and Sellus and etc. Minerva is with us still, of course. And her Catholic guys, she's the Virgin Mary. They even share the same magnificent basilica in Rome, the Basilica of St. Mary of Minerva. But most goddesses and gods were associated with a particular tribe, a certain town, a Bronze Age empire, etc. And what was the God of Abraham doing in Shinar anyway? Not his jurisdiction. Well, here it gets extra confusing on purpose, as if Bible readers were scattered to the four winds, confused by everything. The Lord in those earlier parts of Genesis is a different God than the one who starts playing with Abram and Sarah like a couple of Barbie dolls in the back shed, do you know what I mean? It's such a weird story. It's like that White Lotus show with more incest. Sarah is Abram's sister, but also his wife. Why not? You've only got one Barbie and one Ken. But then you've also got a Pharaoh doll for some reason. Maybe from the Disney cartoon. So Yul Brynner looks at the Sarah Barbie and says, "Baby, you know I got a harem back at the palace, and let's get you out of those dusty cowpoke clothes and dress you up like a belly dancer." Sarah says, "Well," and Abram says, "Go ahead, she's only my sister." And then he sort of mutters under his breath, "And my wife." This comes a little later when the new Lord, who is not the El of the Shinar Desert River Plain, but a character concerned specifically with Abram and Sarah, and specifically with their private life, or lives, tells them to get out of Anatolia and head south towards Egypt. Especially considering that the protagonists of the next 1,000 chapters or so, Abraham and his sister wife, Sarah Sarai, left a big city in Shinar, the city of Ur, on that same Mesopotamian plain, which the British renamed Iraq for some reason after World War I. When Abram and Sarah left, at least a century after the Lord supposedly emptied the cities of the plain, discrepancies in the timeline, every continuity editor's nightmare. But at least we have a reference for what's going on today. The rapid breakdown of all these global communication networks and systems and streamers built over the past half century or so. Nothing works, everything is broken, all the knowledge workers are being shown the virtual door, etc. So we will return to the exciting NC-17 story of Sarah and her cuck husband / brother. We will return to this in a future broadcast. In the meantime, please read the next 20 chapters of Genesis. I promise they are very short chapters. None of this infinite jest nonsense. And there's a way forward, I think, that is presented in this story. Between the incest and the slavery and the concubines and the human sacrifice and the fantastic wealth and the warlord slaughtering anything that moves. Is already happening, of course. The way forward. The big sad real estate news for billionaires this year is that nobody wants to be locked up within massive windowless towers all day long. And businesses also don't want to pay for workers. So the commercial real estate towers of San Francisco and New York City and every other overbuilt skyline on Earth are emptying out by the hour. Many are already completely vacant. Like Abram and Sarah, people are quitting the cities and heading for the countryside. And the suburbs, of course, mostly to the suburbs, if they can afford it. But the interesting people are going to abandoned farming villages, tiny backwoods towns. And we are forming new societies within these out-of-the-way places. We welcome the UPS strike, the movie strikes, the TV strikes, the end of content, and the end of Amazon Prime. Because we will have our own little shops, our locally grown food, etc. A story for another night. A story we are making up right now. You and me. I remember hearing my dad talk about the irrigation canals in Phoenix, on the south side of Phoenix, where he lived from the age of 5 till he lied about his age and joined the Air Force at 16. Those canals were life in the pre-air conditioning days for the cotton pickers. In the summertime, the kids were always in the water. And sometimes they'd find ancient Indian pottery from the civilization that built those canals and then scattered and died. When the kids got older, they'd water ski in those canals by tying a rope to the trailer hitch on whatever jalopy was around and dragging another kid on skis. You could get up to 40 miles per hour when the dirt road alongside the canal was nice and smooth. My dad's half-brother, my half-uncle, I suppose, drowned in one of those canals when he was just a toddler. Anyway, if you live in Phoenix today, you might want to get your exit plans in order. If Palos Verde ever goes offline, you're going to melt. You want to get up someplace higher, around 7,000 feet. Los Alamos is nice at an elevation of 7,320 feet. It gets real cold up there in wintertime, but you'll get used to it. Plus, it's still sunny and beautiful even in the winter. But the real estate is not cheap. You don't want to end up like Bob Lazar with a high school diploma and collection agencies always on your tail, renting some worn-out little dump and developing vacation photos for the well-off scientists at the government lab. I want to tell you about a very interesting American character who had his formative experiences in the high desert mountains of Los Alamos, New Mexico. Maybe you've heard of him, heard about how he was a communist and the child of privilege and eventually became a household name in the mid-20th century. I'm speaking of Gore Vidal, of course. A blood relative and family relation of Al Gore and stepbrother to Jackie Kennedy through one of his parents' later marriages. Gore Vidal was enrolled at the Los Alamos Ranch School for Boys in 1940. He went on to write some of the greatest novels of the 20th century, including the strange and hilarious Burr about Aaron Burr and Hamilton, which should have been the basis for a big Broadway musical had it been written by somebody smarter. But you're probably thinking of another child of privilege who was forever affected by his time riding horses and camping out under the clear, cold desert skies of Los Alamos and the big, beautiful country surrounding that little ranch. I'm speaking of William S. Burroughs, of course, who, along with Gore Vidal, would become notorious for his piercing and shocking and poetic satire of America. But by way of introduction, we will first deal with another American character, one named J. Robert Oppenheimer. And if you want more on that subject, consult Desert Oracle issue number 3 from the autumn of 2015, or the paperback book Desert Oracle Volume 1, the latter being available at all your favorite independent desert bookshops. As the Second World War infected the Old World and most of Europe's great physicists collected in the United States, many of them began to suffer nightmare visions of a new weapon that would make Germany unstoppable. Washington, the celebrated scientist, insisted, must build the atomic bomb first. Much of the authority for this Manhattan Project fell to J. Robert Oppenheimer, a suspected communist and wealthy New York-born scientist who adventured to New Mexico like so many others, other elites, I mean, for the fashionable dry air cure at a guest ranch in 1922. Oppenheimer's affliction was not tuberculosis, the then incurable illness that once brought thousands of lungers to New Mexico, but dysentery, likely caused by infectious colitis. The disease kept him bedridden for what was supposed to be his first year at Harvard, so Oppenheimer was taken to New Mexico. His father, Julius, was a wealthy industrialist and collector of modern art. And it was Julius Oppenheimer who proposed the New Mexico trip, believing that, quote, a Western adventure would help to harden his son. According to Kai Bird and Martin J. Sherwin's 2006 biography, American Prometheus. As part of this frontier adventure, the 18-year-old Oppenheimer rode from the guest ranch near Cowles to the stark slope of the Pajarito Plateau, and across the great caldera. Beyond the old cave dwellings and Pueblo, the only permanent settlement was the rough-hewn, all-male Los Alamos Ranch School, with its prep school cowboys doing ranch chores between classical studies. The junior Oppenheimer was so taken with the brilliant landscape, the cowboy life, and the arid climate that he later leased and eventually bought the little ranch near Cowles for himself. And when the need arose for a remote location for America's World War II effort to build the A-bomb, Oppenheimer suggested that part of New Mexico he loved best, the mountains north of Santa Fe. After all, his twin obsessions in life were, quote, physics and desert country. Or, as he wrote in another letter, my two great loves are physics and New Mexico. Oppenheimer was also a mystic, which was not uncommon amongst the East Coast Americans drawn to New Mexico in the early 20th century. While his agile mind maneuvered easily through physics, both hard and theoretical, there remained a gauze at the frontiers that baffled him. He studied Sanskrit and took to the ancient Hindu texts, a deep interest that merged with his profession years later, following the successful detonation of the first atomic bomb on July 16, 1945, Trinity. It was two decades later when Oppenheimer, abandoned by his government and near death, recalled his thoughts about the A-bomb for NBC television cameras. We knew the world would not be the same, he said. A few people laughed, a few people cried, most people were silent. I remembered the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Vishnu is trying to persuade the prince that he should do his duty and, to impress him, takes on his multi-armed form and says, now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds. I suppose we all thought that, one way or another. In that ancient story, the human prince, Arjuna, accepts his responsibility to fight a war even though he feels that the war is unjust. He is convinced that his profession requires his full participation. Oppenheimer was not suggesting that he had become death, the destroyer of worlds. Although it sounds good. Instead, his earthly profession required him to be the war god's proxy. It was Oppenheimer's duty, and because it was his duty, he did not regret the A-bomb's destruction of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. Oppenheimer's choice for the Manhattan Project's laboratory site, quickly accepted by the U.S. government, was that same picturesque private school he had visited on a horseback camping trip years earlier. Set along a creek crowded with Fremont's cottonwoods, Los Alamos in Spanish, on the mesa east of the volcano and west of the Sangre de Cristo mountain range. The climate and views would inspire the great minds called to this duty, he believed. The final graduating class of the Los Alamos Ranch School rushed to complete their studies by February of 1943. The school had been created by a Detroit businessman named Ashley Pond, who had served in Theodore Roosevelt's Rough Riders but missed the war thanks to a case of typhoid. The ranch school's mission was to toughen up the sons of the American elite. Pond believed in the gender segregation that some Pueblos practiced to create elite warriors. They didn't even want the male teachers to have wives. The ranch school graduated a number of notable business and artistic figures, including the aforementioned Gore Vidal and John Crosby, founding director of the Santa Fe Opera. But the strangest and most brilliant of them all was a boy called Billy Burroughs, grandson of the man who invented the adding machine. William S. Burroughs was born to a wealthy St. Louis family, and despite a lifetime at odds with the morals and social order of America's prim elite, his lasting persona was that of a corny old-time Western gentleman. Whether founding the Beats with Kerouac and Ginsberg, portraying a priestly old heroin addict in Gus Van Sant's Drugstore Cowboy, or creating shotgun art with a disheveled Kurt Cobain, Burroughs dressed like an undertaker in a rumpled suit, not dapper but shady. Burroughs' writing is packed with studied paranoia regarding government, technology, weapons, taboos, and especially the virus of language, which Burroughs believed was the result of deliberate infection by alien management. It was a reversal of the Tower of Babel story. The gods did not confuse our language, the gods infected us with language. They destroyed the magical natural world we once roamed. After stints with his brother Mortimer in 1925 and 27, 16-year-old Burroughs was sent to the school as a full-time student in 1930, in part because he suffered sinus problems. Most of the boys there were spindly, sent by rich fathers, hoping the desert would toughen them up. Burroughs begged to come home late in his second year and later wrote that he loathed the ranch school's dull chores, cruel classmates, and a headmaster who privately enjoyed making the teen boys strip naked and prance around for him. But in William S. Burroughs' fiction, especially in his later novels such as The Wild Boys and The Place of Dead Roads, a fantastic version of this Old West-themed all-male school of horseback-riding junior cowboys is the Burroughsian ideal of a perfect society, out of doors and out of control's reach. It is the Los Alamos Ranch School before the A-bomb, the cowboy adolescence without the teachers, without the military men who took over the school, and without the scientists seeking moral justification for bringing the world to the verge of man-made destruction. Burroughs, who was interested enough in anthropology to briefly study the science at Harvard, enjoyed roaming around the Pueblo ruins and cave dwellings. Ted Morgan describes one such ramble in the book Literary Outlaw, The Life and Times of William S. Burroughs. Quote, Roger Scudder, a St. Louis friend who went to the ranch school with Billy, also remembers him as wry and sardonic, with a macabre side. He and Billy used to go dig in an old Pueblo Indian ruin. Billy found an anthill in the ruin and poured gasoline over it and lit it, and started dancing a sort of parody of an Indian war dance, with maniacal whooping as ants by the thousands fled the pyre. Young Billy Burroughs knew about the war captains. He knew about the gods infecting the humans for purposes of war duty. Yet even when he volunteered for the military and then the OSS, he was unable to perform. Burroughs attended two of the same elite universities as J. Robert Oppenheimer, too, Harvard and Columbia, the latter campus, and New York being the original headquarters of the Manhattan Project. They studied many of the same esoteric Eastern texts in their comfortable Cambridge lodgings. But unlike the war captains of the Pueblos and unlike Oppenheimer, Burroughs could not do the duty of the gods. Not the war gods, anyway. His job, as it transpired, was to turn the atomic age into the darkest comedy, and satire so outrageous and relentlessly belittling that the 1960s generation would see these pillars of American government and commerce as little more than lunatics, born to money and power. You've been listening to Desert Oracle Radio. Find out more, if you must, by visiting desertoracle.com. Soundscapes by Red, Blue, Black, Silver. Good night from the voice of the desert.
J.
Transmitting from the Mojave Wilderness in Joshua Tree, California. Now is the time for Desert Oracle Radio, the voice of the desert.
Night has fallen on the desert. And it sure is dark out there. The moon has yet to rise, but it's coming up soon, just another couple of minutes. Waning gibbous, if anyone asks. 86% full tonight, 86.4 to be very specific. On its way to becoming the third quarter moon, because that means it's three quarters of the way between full moon and new moon. Still enough moonlight to see the mountains around you. The Desert Oracle Radio Studio looks right out at that very mountain, the transmission tower blinking up top. And I do love staring out at the nighttime desert, the shadow figures of Joshua trees and yucca trees, little lights here and there. Sometimes you see a bright light on the horizon for a long time, brighter than Venus, but wrong direction. It takes a while to figure out that every now and then you see the white headlight of a passenger plane for the longest time. And it eventually seems to climb up high, and then it's just the regular Southwest 1150 out of Albuquerque and the perfect atmospheric conditions and nautical twilight. So you're watching that plane at 33,000 feet, but it seems like it's just hovering over the dark horizon. The light is magnified like a sunset. When these plane lights get very bright right before what appears to be a rapid climb, from your point of view, sometimes you get a glint of sunlight too, the way satellites sometimes catch the sunlight about an hour after dark, almost astronomical dark down here. One time I was walking up that mountain on the dirt service road that goes up to the transmitter tower, and I saw this good-sized rattlesnake spread out on the road. Right there where it gets real narrow, where it's cut into the steepest part of the mountain, you can't really go around, there's nowhere to go. But I've got my old dog with me, so I tell the dog to sit, and I walk over to get a better look, and the thing is totally still. And I see the fresh tire tracks from the radio engineer's big off-road service truck. And I'm thinking, does it look flattened? So I go up and lightly prod the snake with my stick. And of course, it jumps to life and it's about 5 feet long and all green and terrible. Luckily, it went down the slope and not me. It's easier to go down that slope on your belly. I look back and there there's the dog, sitting there in the shade of a juniper, staring at me. There's the moon. And there's the mountain in the light of the waning moon. There's the blinking tower. One time I asked my uncle back in Phoenix how he knew the distances to all the mountains around us. Because you're surrounded by mountains in Phoenix, and you learn the names of the distinctive peaks, the biggest visible mountains. So everybody knows Camelback Mountain because from central Phoenix it looks just like a camel's back. My uncle showed me on a pack of cigarettes, but there's also a pyramid on that pack of cigarettes, so it's not the best visual aid. And he says, I've lived here since I was 5 years old. If you don't know the mountains you see every day after 50 years of living someplace, the problem is you. It is, I suppose, my professional obligation to have an opinion on the UFO congressional hearings in Washington. But before I do, I suggest you read the newspaper coverage and come to your own conclusions. Pay special attention to how little was said and why it was so deliberately vague and intentionally sinister. History, science, factual knowledge, whatever you call it, none of that changed an iota over the course of that C-SPAN subcommittee session. And the recycled science fiction testimony, not a single event was illuminated, not a single find, not a single report. Whatever this is about, this is not what it's about. UFOs, flying saucers, unidentified aerial phenomena, as are thrown around these days. Are experienced around the world by people. The United States military and the U.S. intelligence agencies do not control what happens around the world all the time, although they'd very much like to. What happens around the world late at night on lonely back roads, out in the backwoods, over the lonely desert and mountain lakes, floating around the sacred springs and sacred groves and sacred mountains of every culture, for as long as human beings have existed, not the business of the Pentagon. Not the weapons part of the Pentagon, anyway. We've talked about this subject fairly often on Desert Oracle Radio on the Desert Oracle view of the flying saucer situation. I'll link a couple of those previous episodes on our blog at desertoracle.com. Better yet, read a book. I'll link a couple of books, too. Operation Trojan Horse, in particular, by the late, great John A. Keel. And don't forget Passport to Magonia, by Jacques Vallée. What sort of response are you hearing to this background noise about congressional subcommittees and wild claims about spaceships? I don't know how much it's resonating in the broader culture. My sample size is sort of corrupted out here. On social media, I've seen a lot of younger people saying, correctly, that unless the rumored dead space aliens are going to provide student loan relief and universal health care and a much more rapid shift to clean energy and overall a political system that shows the slightest interest in the continued existence of the human population, not to mention the flora and fauna, well, then the rumored aliens are going to have to get in line. We got heat waves. We got the rapid increase in carbon fuel burning at the absolute worst time for it, and really a failed system in most nations around the world. Aliens in this economy? So the news is not exactly a barn burner, which is probably why they tucked it away in what the Central Europeans call cucumber season. Time for the weird news, the crazy stories, late summer. The people with seniority and power tend to take vacations. And so that's when all the goofy stuff bubbles up. And most younger people have a poor opinion of defense contractors and the Pentagon and cops in general. Support for the U.S. military is at a quarter century low. Last time it was this bad for the Pentagon was just before 9/11. And everybody has a poor opinion of the U.S. Congress. So you put on this potato head, lifetime military intel agent who also works for a Scientology science fiction company on the side. Didn't mention that in the testimony, but it's on his resume. And you get a couple of waterhead congresspeople asking questions that could be answered in 10 minutes of reading on the subject. And it's just a lot of wild stories, no evidence, no nothing. So I heard. Nothing but that internet favorite in a time of confusion. Trust me. Trust me, bro. The male population is not doing great in this country, and that makes for big changes in a society. A lot of men in their 20s and 30s, pushing 40, they're thinking reasonably, what's the point of all this? Millennial men are the demographic for militias, for torchlit marches, for takeovers of capitals and wildlife refuges. They're avoiding college, they're avoiding marriage, they're avoiding full-time work. And listen, I've avoided all three, though not always successfully. No judgment. But it's a demographic the nation's law enforcement and intelligence agencies are intensely interested in talking to, covertly. They are especially interested in steering these younger adult men away from violence, away from mobs, away from sociopathic behavior, that threatens the already threatened stability of the United States. A couple years back now, this FBI report made the news warning of, quote, a persistent threat of lethal violence, end quote, from unmoored white men. Now, whatever you think of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, keeping tabs on anybody they're worried about, rightly or wrongly, is one of the FBI's infamous specialties. This report summarized a particular concern, which caused a brief outrage, before being dropped like everything is always dropped by everybody eventually. But by the 2010s, the second decade of this young century, there was an aggressively public form of extremist male political groups that had not been seen in such numbers in a while, since the 1980s White Aryan Resistance War, which was part of my newspaper beat in Fallbrook, California, back in the 1980s. Go talk to Tom Metzger, my editor would tell me, so I'd drive out to Tom's mobile home in Fallbrook, and he'd proudly show me all the press coverage he'd collected. Oh, he loved the attention. For a decade or so after 9-1-1, we all pretended that sinister Middle Eastern men were doing all the bad things, but it turned out to be the men who were already here, nominally Christian, who did all the domestic terrorism. The FBI also found quite a few of those men actually did have full-time jobs in police and sheriff's departments. And then the strangest thing happened on the front page of the New York Times, which soon filtered down to every form of social media, and especially the suddenly thriving UFO groups on Reddit and Facebook and other such platforms. In a very vague way that specifically spoke to people who ignored or did not understand the details and all the carefully hedged language, an office at the Pentagon suddenly announced that it was investigating UFOs. And that there were some real UFOs, whatever that means. But only the U.S. military knew anything about it. And within a few weeks, the first of several rounds of military whistleblowers started getting their own shows on the History Channel, speaking at the UFO conferences. They became celebrities within the suddenly crowded UFO fan clubs. Umberto Eco says you can tell a lunatic, quote, by the fact that sooner or later he brings up the Templars. At first they seem normal, then all of a sudden. Well, the same goes for UFOs, doesn't it? Everything eventually goes back to UFOs, the Knights Templar, the mob, MK Ultra, JFK, Charles Manson. But those last things are real. Real things done by real people. MK Ultra was real, although the agency did its best to destroy all the evidence. Luckily for researchers, they missed a remote location where thousands of files had been hidden away. Files that were not purged when Congress came looking for proof after Seymour Hersh broke the story on the front page of the New York Times. Hersh had the story to himself. For some mysterious reason, the other newspapers never picked it up. The TV network news never picked it up. And before long, the most outrageous criminal behavior in CIA history, done right here on American soil, where it's illegal for them to do anything, was forgotten. Left to the cranks and the weirdos and the Manson family researchers. Welcome to the Ninth Tower. Things did not go as planned for a woman who tried to help what she believed to be an injured lemur in San Antonio. The woman wound up fleeing her vehicle, leaving the angry animal inside and calling the city for help. San Antonio Animal Care Services announced that the woman, identified only as Miss Yu, was driving at night when she spotted a small, strange creature on the side of the road, apparently injured. She naturally thought it was a lemur, a rare primate from Madagascar. So she used a towel to pick it up and put it in her car. While her intentions to help the animal were pure, said the social media post from the city of San Antonio, the animal quickly became agitated, and Miss Yu had to exit her vehicle and call 311 for help. A moment of misplaced kindness had turned to panic. Quote, animal care officer Centano responded to the call regarding a reported lemur wreaking havoc. Miss Yu was driving along in the evening when she spotted an injured animal on the side of the road. Officer Centano arrived shortly later and identified this animal as not a lemur, but a ringtail cat. Ringtails are nocturnal little creatures native to San Antonio. Though they look like a cross between a cat and a fox and a lemur, they are in the same family as raccoons and coatimundis. Their elusive nature makes seeing them in the wild a rare treat. Officer Centano carefully removed the ringtail from the woman's car and took it to the animal emergency room, where it was treated for unspecified injuries and transferred to the care of Wildlife Rescue and Rehabilitation on the following day. City Animal Control Services asked citizens to report injured wildlife to Animal Control, and generally to not pick up wild animals with a towel and put them in your car. You know you're going to hear this kind of story when we go into the Ninth Tower. Miles south of San Antonio, the people of Mission, Texas, were baffled by the creature photographed by a trail camera in Benson Rio Grande Valley State Park. They came up with everything from a pregnant dog to a chupacabra. There's a CIA report about planning chupacabra stories in Puerto Rico. I gotta dig that up. But in Mission, Texas, the consensus from wildlife biologists was that the long, low-to-the-ground creature was a badger. Or, perhaps, a person in a badger suit. Thank you. a nice breeze. From Amboy to Zizek's and across the great Mojave Wilderness, you've been listening to Desert Oracle Radio with musical soundscapes by our own Red, Blue, Black, Silver. I'm your host, Ken Lane. This show is supported by listeners, and I want to thank all the patrons of the show for keeping us on the air now in our sixth year. No commercials during the show, isn't that nice? On the air and on your podcast player. It has been a pretty lean summer, as it often is once the tourists quit visiting, so thanks to our new patrons this month and those who upped their pledge, always great to see. Bruna, Garrett, Nicholas, Johan, Joe, Lisa, Christopher, and Gary, Carrie, Suzanne, Scott, and somebody who goes by the moniker Strange Brother. Thanks to you all and everybody who subscribes to the periodical at DesertOracle.com. You've probably heard about the big fire in the East Mojave, a wonderful part of the Mojave Wilderness, Mojave National Preserve. It's bad, of course, and we know there will be more big fires, and it gets depressing. I know and love that specific place. It gets depressing. While you can't bring it back exactly like it was, you can sure help the direction that it goes in the years to come. And after that big fire on SEMA Dome several years ago, that's exactly what volunteers did. They showed up from Las Vegas and Los Angeles and all the little towns in the Mojave, and they planted thousands of baby Joshua trees, which are coming up. So think about that. Sign up for that, huh? Thanks for listening, and good night from the Voice of the Desert.
Ken has quite a way of weaving current events in history. I always find myself pondering some of his observations long after I listen. Do you? Today, I'm also pondering how to be present in this moment, now. And I imagine that's because I've been enjoying family visits and traveling for a good part of the year. It takes me a while to feel grounded again. Is that how it is for you? Well, next week, I'll tell you more. But for now, thank you, Gallatin Valley and beyond, for listening. As always, you can call me and leave a message about anything on your mind. The number is 406-404-6246. Remember to spread the word that you can hear this program on the air at 95.9 FM, Bozeman Community Radio, or you can stream it online at kgbm.org at 7 p.m. Sunday and 9 a.m. Monday. Our past Desert Oracle radio replay episodes are also available on demand on the kgbm.org website. That's it for today. So till next time, listeners, be safe, stay well, and sweet dreams. I'll be back next week with reflections on my travels and another Desert Oracle radio episode. Thanks to you, too, for taking us out today. The flame. Where